What's going on, everybody? And thank you so much for tuning in. So today I am excited to have author Jay Kristoff joining me. Jay, how's it going over there?
Good, man. I'm good. It's early morning here for me and late at night for you. But yeah, my days are starting, but it's all good.
Yeah. It's, you know, it's always interesting, you know, getting the perspective of somebody who's like a day forward.
Yeah, we're ahead in time. The world is still here on Wednesday morning. Yeah.
Right, exactly. It's like, okay, good. Thank God we're still here for another morning. It's always a little jarring because I'm sitting there looking outside, you know, and it's like pitch black. You're just getting that little bit of, you know, sunshine coming in.
I just had my morning coffee, yeah.
I probably need to have a night coffee, dude. Like, it's been a struggle staying awake this afternoon. I don't know if kids, but man, gosh, they're freaking exhausted.
I believe it. I just got a dog and he's bad enough. So.
Oh, yeah. See, that's how we started. We decided like a year before our daughter was born, we were going to get a puppy just to like see if we could keep it alive for a year. And, yeah, right. And it works, but like it does not get you anywhere remotely close to a kid.
Yeah, I believe it.
So I just want to start out like I always do these. Just tell me a little bit about yourself. Growing up, did you read a lot growing up? Did you write growing up? Did writing come later in life? And then just how did you get into writing, seriously?
Yeah. I was always a reader. The first fantasy book I read was The Hobbit when I was like 8 years old. And that was kind of the gateway drug in a fantasy for me. It's probably true of a lot of people, but I kind of wandered all around. Like, I very quickly fell into horror and started reading a lot of Stephen King and sci-fi, kind of reading old golden age sci-fi. So I had a bit of a weird taste, but it was always genre fiction. For a long while, I was kind of an art student kid. Like, I was very visually minded. So I studied graphic design at university and I ended up working in advertising for a career. So I was a creative in an advertising agency, and basically I wrote TV scripts all day. So I wrote in my spare time, but it revolved around RPGs. Like, I used to DM Dungeons and Dragons games and stuff like that. So I used to, you know, flex the world building muscles in that sense. But in terms of writing cohesive story, it really started with writing ads. Like, if you can tell a story in 30 seconds with 100 words, then I mean, that's what all good advertising is. It's a story. It's a 30-second short film. That's what the good ones do. Most of them don't do that. But yeah, that was a pretty good grounding in terms of understanding the fundamentals of story. But the problem working in ads is that you're throwing a lot of creative energy into it. Like, it's a really cool job, and I had a lot of fun doing it. But ultimately, you don't have a lot of control over the end product. Like, you might write the best script that you've ever written, and then it will get killed at any number of hurdles along the way, either internally by clients or client service, or it will go into market research and just die the death of 1,000 cuts. So it can be pretty heartbreaking throwing all this energy into something that you ultimately don't have control over.
Yeah.
So in my spare time, I just started working on a scene. It was like an idea for a scene that I had, and I wrote it down, and that scene became a chapter, and I kept writing, and that chapter became a book. I didn't tell anyone that I was doing it. Like, my wife didn't even know what I was doing. I would just kind of go into the study at night and write. And it wasn't until the book was kind of probably 3/4 finished that I even told her that I was doing it, because, you know, it was a weird thing to just decide to do. And I wasn't sure if I was ever going to finish it. So I didn't want to tell her that I was doing it in case I didn't. But that was the book. I mean, it's a bad book, or most first books tend to be bad books, but that was the book that kind of made me fall in love with the idea of writing and going to some place that was entirely mine, that I had control over. So it would either work or it wouldn't, based on my ability and what I wanted to do with it, rather than some external force that I couldn't control. So yeah, that's kind of how it all started. But yeah, it was late in life, man. I didn't start writing that book until I'm like 35. That was when I first sat down to write a novel. So yeah, anyone who tells you have to do it by the time you're 21 is full of it.
And those ones that do by 21, you just kind of raise your fist a little bit.
Yeah, like, it's wild.
I've been that.
Yeah, it's exceptional. Like, those people are extraordinary. I'm friends with Veronica Roth, who wrote the Divergent series, and she put out that first book when she was 21. I know that if I had been that young and achieved that level of success, I would have just turned into a monster. But she's the coolest person ever. Like, she's the most generous, down to earth, sweetest person you're ever going to meet. So I'm glad I didn't come to it early.
Just like, you just like hold all the power, you know?
I'd be a horrible human being.
I guess that's like what happens to celebrities, you know, like, you know, they all start off kind of young, and then like they kind of let it corrupt them, you know, as they get a little bit older, and then
I think
a lot of them kind of fizzle out.
It would be really hard for it not to corrupt you, particularly if you're young when it comes to you. Like, you don't really have a sense of the way the world works for regular people yet, and you get thrown into this extraordinary world where everyone is telling that you're amazing and you have all this money and you can do whatever you want. It would take an exceptional human being to stay grounded and centered in that. So that's why I love Veronica, man. She's just a totally down to earth person, and she sold like millions and millions and millions of copies. So yeah, it's an extraordinary person that holds it together under that level of fame.
Yeah. Yeah. It kind of reminds me, you know, I always said, like, going through like high school and college, that, you know, students need like a course on like financial stability for like when they get out in the real world. And that was just like, was never a thing. And you always look at like professional sports players, like
sure,
a lot of them come from nothing. And then all of a sudden they're just like given this like massive paycheck, and they're like,
so you have a $7 million contract. What do you do? Yeah.
You go buy a house, you buy your parents a house, you buy them a car, you buy yourself a car.
And then exactly. You got your money. Yeah. Congrats.
Exactly. It's nuts. Yeah. It's an interesting thing that you didn't tell your wife you were writing a book. You see, my wife has always encouraged me to write a book, and I haven't done it. So maybe I should just like left it with like, now I'm never going to write a book, and then just do it. Don't tell her.
Yeah. I mean, she was amazingly supportive when I told her. Like, she's probably the most well-read person that I've ever met. And she reads all my stuff, and she's kind of my first crit reader. It wasn't for lack of encouragement or anything. It was a weird thing for me to have decided to do. And I was more afraid that I would declare, I'm going to write a book, because anyone can write a book, and then, you know, it fizzles out and becomes nothing. I didn't want to be embarrassed. So once I was at the point where I was pretty sure I'm actually going to finish this thing, and it was safe to tell her, then I told her.
I gotcha. Yeah, I can imagine, like, I'm writing a book. Oh, when are you going to finish it? I'm never now. I'm just not going to.
Yeah, now that I've said I'm going to, I'm never going to.
Yeah. So as far as, like, influences and stuff growing up, I mean, I know you said you read The Hobbit, and you started reading, like, King and a lot of genre fiction. Who would you say were, like, some of your biggest influences when you did start writing, and then it maybe even continued through your books now?
William Gibson was a big one in terms of style. He was the first writer I kind of read and studied, like, how he was doing what he was doing in terms of sentence structure, in terms of story structure, in terms of chapter structure. Like, he was someone I studied the craft of rather than just the words and the story. So he was a big one. Stephen King's On Writing is kind of a Bible. I think that's one of the best books written about writing fiction ever, and I still kind of sometimes go back and flick through the pages when I'm stuck. In terms of individual works, like, the big influences on Empire were Anne Rice. Interview with the Vampire is a massive one. I went back and kind of studied the craft of that book, how she did what she did. Like, it's one of my favorite books, but I hadn't read it in, God, 20 years. And so once I decided on the framing structure for Empire, I kind of went back and studied the way she did that book, as well as Blood Song by Anthony Ryan, which is a great epic fantasy work, and Name of the Ruined by Pat Rothfuss, of course, is a huge one as well. But Interview is probably the biggest influence. Like, the chronicler in, say, Name of the Wind, for example, isn't really omnipresent in the story. Like, there are chapters where you cut away to him and Quoth kind of sitting in the inn, and they'll have a chat with each other, but he's not present in the story. Like, the chapters where Quoth is talking, it's just all first. Whereas I wanted the chronicler and Empire to be more omnipresent in the story. So he's kind of continuously jumping in for points of clarification, or just to give Gabriel shit because he's a vampire and Gabriel is a vampire hunter, and they don't particularly like each other. So I wanted a more kind of dynamic feel between the two of them. And that's kind of what Anne Rice did in Interview. Like the chronicler in Interview is more of a presence throughout the narrative. So yeah, that was a big one.
Yeah, I really liked how the chronicler and Gabriel really played off of each other. And I know that's a lot of people really enjoyed that. I've read a lot of reviews that kind of mentioned that tongue in cheek. You know, they're back and forth, just jabs at each other. It's a fantastic kind of little palate cleanser in between the kind of flashbacks and the present tense parts of the chapters.
It was also an opportunity to, like I say, for points of clarification. Like, you know, there's an acknowledgement, almost a meta acknowledgement in text, that the people who are reading it don't know anything about this world. And so Jean-Francois says, you know, this book is written for people who will live hundreds of years from now in a place very different from here. So he's in part playing a role of audience surrogate as well, because, you know, it's a big new fantasy world and you need to introduce all those concepts to your readers. So it would be quite strange for two people who live in a world explaining the way their world works to each other without some kind of artificial structure built around it.
Right.
Otherwise you very quickly find yourself in, you know, as you know, John territory.
Yeah.
As you know, Jean-Francois territory, I guess.
So you kind of find yourself going, okay, so they know a lot about it. And I'm not getting clued in at all.
Yeah. Or is, why is this guy telling this vampire the way vampires work? Like, right. He knows. He is one. Yeah.
Exactly. As far as your craft, you mentioned, you know, Stephen King's book, which, I mean, that gets mentioned all the time as just one of the best craft books ever.
It's amazing.
How did you kind of hone your craft from, you know, your first, you know, your throwaway novel, as everybody kind of calls their first, to now? You know, have you kind of figured out how your writing process works? Is it different every time a new book or new series is introduced?
It depends a little bit on the book. Like with my co-authored work with Amy, we have to be a lot more buttoned down in terms of pre-production and planning, because, you know, when you're working with a co-author, you need to know what the co-author has in their head and what they're planning to do. Like if there's some secondary character that you're planning some big reveal around and your co-author decides that character is getting killed in an action scene, then that's going to mess everything up. So Amy and I have to be quite meticulous in the way we plan the structure of our books. And typically speaking, when I was working on my solo stuff, I would just pants it. I'd just make it up as I went along. So it was kind of completely different ways of working. Like I liken it as to, it's like I was driving towards a city on the horizon, the city being the end of the novel. If I have the ending in mind and I keep the car on the road kind of pointed towards that city, I will eventually reach the city. I don't know what streets I'm going to take to get there. And I might go into a cul-de-sac and have to back the car up or whatever, but eventually I will get to where I want to be. But it was different with Empire, because Empire was bigger than anything that I had done before, both in terms of word count and the world that I was building and just the story that I was telling. It's kind of, you know, it's three books in one. It's the framing device and then two different parts of Gabriel's life. One when he's 15, one when he's 32, and they're kind of weaving in and out of each other. They're events in one are kind of informing outcomes in the other.
Mm-hmm.
So level of complexity was just much bigger than I had ever done before. It was the hardest book that I'd ever written. So when I was about halfway through it, I realized that unless I sat down and plotted this thing and worked out exactly what was going to happen, it was just going to keep sprawling. Like, yeah, I initially wrote, you know, call it Young Gabe and Old Gabe. I was writing Young Gabe and Old Gabe kind of side by side for a little while because they were bouncing in and out of each other. But eventually I just started writing Young Gabe. And I wrote that plot line almost all the way through to the end. And by itself, it was 200,000 words. Like, it was fucking huge. And so if I had done that with Old Gabe, it would just be a brick of a book.
Right.
So in the end, I had to actually sit down and realize, like, if I don't put a rein on this thing, it's just going to get out of control. So about halfway through the book, I sat down and kind of meticulously plotted it out the way I do with Amy. So Empire was kind of different to something like Never Night, for example. Never Night, I flew by the seat of my pants pretty much the whole trilogy. So it varies from work to work.
Yeah, I gotcha. Yeah, I mean, you know, It's funny how you say, you know, it'd be a, you know, thick book. I mean, it's still pretty thick, even
it's
after
a beast.
All that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not Game of Thrones, but it's pretty big. Yeah.
Yeah.
Second one will probably be bigger. So.
Good gosh.
I mean, sequels tend to just be longer. Yeah.
Right.
And like, you just tend to sprawl by about 10 or 20% given. So yeah, the next one will probably be a little bit bigger.
So as far as your writing, so like you did mention, you know, you've got a lot of solo projects and you do have some duo projects with Amy. Talk a little bit about, you know, you've already talked about your writing process a little bit between both of them, but, you know, how did your writing with Amy kind of come about? Do y'all know each other really well? Did y'all just decide like, hey, let's co-write a series together? Or was it something more of like, publisher put you guys together? How did that work out?
No, it was very strange. So there is, if you are a foreign resident earning income in the United States, so for example, my publisher in the US pays me, they pay the US government tax, and I pay the US government tax on my earnings in America before I get paid in Australia. If you're in that situation, you need what's called an international tax identification number, ITIN. It's like a social security number, but for foreign residents. And the process by which you get this number it's like something out of Terry Gilliam's Brazil. Like, it's this completely archaic, arcane process. The labyrinth you have to run through to get this goddamn number is insane. And it costs you like a couple of $100 every time you try. And when you fail, and you will inevitably fail, they don't tell you why. They just kind of say failed and send your stuff back.
Oh my gosh.
And you have to try again. It's crazy. And so I had just signed my first deal for my first series. And after like 3 attempts, I think I got this ITIN number so I could get paid. And it just so happened that Amy had signed her first book deal, the first series that she wrote with Megan Spooner, her other co-author. And she was at work and she was trying to work out this process. And like, she's a lawyer. So she's, you know, pretty well versed in terms of government bureaucracy, and she couldn't figure this thing out. She was swearing in her office, and a colleague of hers kind of walked past her office door and he's like, what's the deal? What's the problem? And she's like, I'm trying to get this goddamn number. I can't figure out how to do it. And he said, well, one of my friends, Jay, just went through that process. So I'll give you his email and you can email him and find out how to do it. She's like, okay, cool. So she emailed me out of the blue, said, hi, I'm a friend of Nick's. I heard you know the secret handshake by which I can get this number. I'll buy you breakfast and, you know, you can tell me how to do it. So we just met up completely out of the blue. Like, it was just a work colleague of hers was a buddy of mine. And because we were both kind of baby authors, just kind of getting started, we would meet up every month and just have breakfast and shoot about, you know, shop talk basically. And about 6 months in, she had a dream where we wrote a book together, and she was like, maybe we should give it a go, maybe this is the universe telling us something. And so I was like, yeah, sure, we'll give it a try, not thinking that it would even work, to tell you the truth. Like, in my head, books were something that you wrote by yourself. Co-authoring was just conceptually, it wasn't even on the radar. But funnily enough, when you're working as a creative in an advertising agency, you work in teams. Like, an art director and a copywriter work together. So I had already spent like 13 years working in a creative team environment, just bouncing ideas back and forth between your partner and learning how to set ego aside and take criticism. And so that day job that I had for over a decade was actually a really great training ground to be in a co-author relationship. So yeah, we just worked really well together and started kicking around ideas, and that's where Illuminate came from. So
interesting,
this weird series of coincidences that led to this life-changing novel. Like, that was the first time I hit the New York Times bestseller list, and that was the book that let us quit our day jobs. So it was crazy confluence of events. Yeah,
I mean, yeah, going from I don't even know this is gonna work to yeah, I'm just gonna write for a living now.
Yeah, it's insane. Yeah, it was. I mean, that was the book that changed their lives, yeah.
And all from her crazy. Just swearing in her office. I mean, who would have thunk it, right?
Yeah, and that buddy of mine was a gaming buddy. So like he was a guy I used to role play with. So like all these little, I sometimes sit and think about the confluence of events necessary for that meeting to take place. And through that meeting, I am now living my dream. Like I get to be a full-time author, all the things that needed to happen for that meeting to take place. It drives you crazy if you sit and think about it.
Right. Golly, that's crazy. So, you know, we talked a little bit about Illuminae. I know you've got a new series with her, the Aurora Cycle. Can you talk a little bit about, because I know you've got the third book coming out pretty soon, or has it already come out?
In November. So that's the finale to the trilogy.
Okay, can you talk a little bit about that series? And then also talk about your bigger series, Never Not Chronicle. Just to kind of give a little bit of background to those two series, because I know a lot of people have been talking about them for the past at least year or two. And then we'll talk a little bit more about Empire.
So Aurora Cycle is young adult. The work that I do with Amy is all young adult. It's a sci-fi series. It's kind of our love letter to Star Trek, I guess. Roddenberry era Star Trek. It's about a military academy set in space, a bunch of different races. We have the ability to travel interstellar distances. It's not faster than light. It's wormhole travel, essentially. And there's a bunch of different races have formed an alliance. We kick off the series with a graduating squad from this academy who rescue a girl from an ark ship that has been lost in space, and she's been locked in cryosleep for like 200 years. So she's kind of the classic girl out of time trope. And through meeting her, a series of catastrophic events kind of play out, and they end up having to save the galaxy. So it's our love letter to the sci-fi stuff that we grew up watching. So like Roddenberry era Star Trek, Next Gen Star Trek, Babylon 5 is a massive one. It's our love letter to the stuff that we grew up watching. So first two books are out, and the third one is out in November. That's called Aurora's End. So that's the end of the trilogy. And it's probably my favorite of the trilogy, actually. We got to go a little more sci-fi on this one. And it was a really hard book to write. Time travel is really difficult to do and make work. But yeah, it turned out to be a really cool book. It's a great ending. It's a great book in and of itself, but it's also a great ending of the series. We're really proud of it. So that's out in November. And Nevernight is my epic fantasy series. That's solo title. It's adult, although it's often confused with YA. Like readers send me pictures of it in the YA section all the time, I guess because the protagonist is a teenager, and because my co-authored stuff is YA, so I tend to get put in the YA section when I shouldn't be, because Nevernight is definitely not a YA book.
No.
Empire is certainly not.
No.
Man, people have sent me pictures of Empire in the YA section. It's like,
I think I remember you posted, or somebody posted on your wall, like maybe a couple of weeks ago. It was like, maybe it was in the right when the US release was.
And yeah, it was in a Barnes and Noble.
Holy crap. Like if a kid reads those first couple of chapters, like they're scarred for life.
I mean, I was reading Stephen King at age 10. Like it depends on the kid, I guess. Right. But I don't want to be prescriptive. If you're young and you want to read Empire, that's great. It's all good. Yeah. As long as you know what you're getting in for. Like
exactly.
I don't
this,
mind.
This is not Twilight. It's not.
Sure. So as long as you're aware that you're going into, you know, some pretty deep and dark water, that's all cool. Like I hope you enjoy it. But yeah, it would be like putting a slasher movie in the kids section
at
the video store. You know what I mean? Yeah. So Nevernight is, it's about a girl named Mia Corvair. She is, the series is set in, it's like an amalgam of Merchant Prince Venice and ancient Rome. And the world is in a trinary star system. So the result is that there is always a sun in the sky. It's always day. There's like 2 weeks every 2.5 years where all suns are down. And they get like 2 weeks of night, but other than that, it's daylight all the time. And so it's revolves around a young lady named Mia Corvera, whose parents are murdered by three high-ranking members of the Senate and the military. And she falls into the keeping of a retired assassin who kind of brings her up and trains her in the ways of murder and she, in the first book, she attends basically an assassin school, and she's seeking revenge for the murder of her parents from these kind of higher up. There's like a military commander, a leader of the church, and the leader of the government. So she's got kind of three bigwigs that she's got to whack. And kind of over the course of the trilogy, she learns a little bit about who they are and who she is and what her role in the bigger scheme is. So, yeah, that series wrapped up in 2019 with Dark Dawn, and that was really the first series that kind of put me on the map as far as epic fantasy goes. The fandom kind of developed purely organically. Like there was no fanfare when Nevernight came out. Like no one knew that book existed. It was weird. I was in, because the first book of Nevernight came out when the second book of the Illuminae series was on the horizon. So we were in Chicago, I think, that year for Book Expo America on Random House's dime. We were there early promoting Gemini, me and Amy. And I told my US publishers for Nevernight, I was like, I'm going to be in Chicago at Book Expo America on someone else's dime. Do you want to do anything promotion-wise for Nevernight? And they were like, yeah, nah, it's cool. It's cool. So that kind of let me know where Nevernight kind of ranked in their sales expectations. But, you know, in defiance of all those expectations, the series just kind of took off through pure word of mouth. There was a bunch of bloggers and Instagrammers who just loved that character, and they would talk about her constantly. There was a bunch of incredible fan art done for her. And over the course of kind of the first year, it really started to build. When God's Grave dropped, it kind of started to really pop. And so by the time Dark Dawn came out, again, purely on reader word of mouth, it became an international bestseller. So that was a really valuable lesson to me in terms of just the power of the readership and, you know, the level of gratitude that I feel for the readers who did that for that series is extraordinary. Like I cannot thank you guys enough. Anybody who was part of that phenomenon. It was really special to watch. So yeah, that's Nevernight.
You might say, then you have those kick-ass covers of the UK, man. Those things are freaking,
they were great,
phenomenal. Yeah, I remember when they revealed Dark Dawns, and I was like, oh my gosh, like I had to have a copy of that.
But people get that stuff tattooed on their body. Like the Nevernight fandom is just, like, they're not fans, they're fanatics. Like they're intense. And yeah, so I've seen people with like full chest pieces of the crow on the cover of Nevernight. Someone's got like the cover of Dark Dawn down their leg. And again, that's Kirby Rosanas. He did the cover for Empire in the UK as well. He's just an incredibly talented dude, and really nice as well. He sent me the original illustrations of those three Nevernight covers. I've got them hanging on the wall above the computer. He's like, mailed me one day and says, "Hey man, what's your address? I got a present for you." And he just sent me the originals. Like, he's such a cool dude.
Oh, that's so
incredibly
awesome.
Talented as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And then as far as the series, you're talking about your fandom with fan art and so forth. I mean, you've also got a fan film that was done. I guess, was it right around when Dark Dawn was released, or maybe a little bit before?
Yeah, I think the first episode dropped really soon after Dark Dawn dropped. Yeah. So that was done by a filmmaker named Pierre Ford. She's an Aussie gal. She got funding from Screen Australia, which is like a government arts initiative. And yeah, she pulled together this amazing production. Like, again, it was all just her. She is a machine. She's an incredibly driven lady. And so she's an actress and got a bunch of her friends and got a production team together and yeah, shot three episodes, and they look fantastic, man, for like the things they did with the budget they had. Like, Australia is, it's not a big country. We don't have Hollywood here. We don't have a lot of money, but what they did with what they had is just unreal. So yeah, they're all up on Pierre's YouTube channel. You can go check them out. She took three scenes from the first half of the first book, ones that she liked best, and kind of shot them. And yeah, they look amazing. She did such an incredible job. So yeah, they're on her channel and you can go check them out.
Yeah, but I remember that, kind of the lead up to it, seeing like the different screen caps and stuff that she was posting. Yeah. You were shared on like Twitter and stuff. It was real neat.
Yeah, it was amazing. And that's kind of what I was talking about, that level of just the love people have for that series. Like, the idea that anyone would just wake up one day and say, you know what, I'm gonna make a film about this book. I'm gonna write to the Australian government and get the money and make this happen just because I like this book so much. That level of kind of fanaticism is kind of across the whole fandom. So yeah, that's a really good example of the way readers came to that series and made it way more than I ever expected it to be.
Yeah. Yeah. So we move on to Empire of the Vampire. So your latest epic fantasy beast of a novel, which I had to get 3 copies of it. I couldn't help myself. I mean, awesome. I pre-ordered the US edition, which, you know, you signed all the first editions that came out, which
I did.
My gosh, like the time it was taking to sign all those freaking sheets. And then like
it took me 4 seasons of The West Wing and all of The Wire. Like I would just kind of put it on the background and sign. That's how long it took. it was a lot of signing.
Jeez. And yeah, like I ended up listening to an early copy, Damon Lynch's
narrative. Oh, he did such a good job.
God, it's so good. I had that copy pre-ordered like probably a year ago.
Oh, cool.
And I probably got a couple of chapters in. And I was like, all right, I'm getting the Barnes & Noble edition. And then I messaged my buddy Matt over the Broken Binding, like, hey, you got any more UK copies left? I need to get a copy. So, so I was like, yeah, I had to have both covers, and then I had to add the special edition over here. But
do you have a copy that you read and a copy that you just keep aside and don't actually touch?
I haven't gotten a copy I just read yet. I guess I need to do that. Okay. Is there going to be a paperback? Maybe I'll get a paperback copy.
Yeah, there will be. Yeah.
It's one of those things, like, you know, you got to show how much you love it by like how like busted up the binding is.
Yeah. I love seeing, like, I like seeing readers bring like a pristine copy in like a Mylar bag, like obviously that they love and they want to keep perfect. But I think I like more seeing a book that has just had the hell beaten out of it. Like you can tell it's been on public transport and thrown in the bottom of suitcases and traveled all over the world. Like a book that has been loved. Oh yeah, I like seeing those the best.
Yes, yeah, you got the bent cover, and like there's like some scrapes down it, like a coffee stain. Pages and
spinal broken. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it.
Yeah, I don't have one yet, but I will get one. So so tell the audience, those who haven't had a chance to check out Empire, you know, what's it about? And then I've got a couple of questions about the book, you know, since I've read it, just to try to do some non-spoiler answers.
Sure. So I liken it to, it's what would happen if Interview with the Vampire met The Name of the Wind in an S&M club while the first 5 seasons of Game of Thrones streamed in the background. That's kind of my elevator pitch. But it's set in a medieval European-inspired world with one important difference. 27 years ago, there was an environmental cataclysm called Day's Death, in which the sun stopped shining as brightly in the sky. No one knows why. They still have dawn and dusk, but daylight is drastically reduced in the world. So along with all the ecological catastrophic events that kind of fall out from lowered levels of daylight and UV, in addition to that, in this world, vampires are real and they've figured out that sunlight no longer kills them. So they've started kind of popping up around this empire and doing what vampires do. So the story centers around a guy named Gabriel Deleon. He is the member of the kind of a monastic order of monster hunters known as the Silver Saints. And he begins the book. He's captured by a group of vampires who want to know his life story. And so he starts telling 2 different tales, essentially. One, when he's a young man, he's kind of 15 years old and he's first recruited into the order, kind of learns who he is and what his role is in the greater scheme of things. And the second half of the story is when he's a much older man, he's kind of 32 years old and he became a paragon of the order, but then he's fallen out the other side. He's kind of suffered this fall from grace and he's bitter and broken and jaded and faithless. And he gets dragged almost against his will into a quest to discover the one thing that might actually fix Day's Death and bring back the sun to full strength in the sky. So those are kind of 2 halves of the story and they weave in and out of each other over the course of the first novel. So yeah, that's basically the pitch for it.
I gotcha.
So it's dark, dark, epic fantasy, bloody, sweary, smutty.
Yeah, I mean, you know, kind of what you're known for a little bit, you know, after Never
Dying. A little bit, yeah. Yeah, yeah. True to form. I mean, it's very much a spiritual successor to Never Dying in terms of tone and aesthetic, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of, yeah, dark, gothic, epic fantasy.
I'm curious, what made you kind of lean, I guess, towards that kind of aesthetic? Because it's one that's not, I wouldn't say it's done a whole lot. You know, you get dark fantasy, you get epic fantasy, you get, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, whatever you want to call it in fantasy.
Yep.
But I guess the way in which you do it, I don't feel like is done a lot in the more mainstream, I guess, traditional fantasy that you see. What, I guess, is that something your publisher was looking for? Is that something you're just like, it's going to throw it onto the page and see what happens?
Yeah. I mean, it's the kind of storytelling that I gravitate towards. If I'm left to my own devices, I tend to stray dark. You may not know what to look at me.
Nah.
But yeah, I tend to have a pretty bleak and dark worldview, and that bleeds into the work. I mean, there's a group of us that do it. You know, Joe Abercrombie is another one that I get put alongside a lot. Mark Lawrence, but they tend to be UK authors rather than American authors.
I would agree.
American fantasy is more, it's kind of heroic level fantasy. It's mm-hmm. like high fantasy, I guess you could describe it, you know, writers like Brandon Sanderson. Yeah. Whereas us colonials tend to stray a little darker. Maybe it's got something to do with the weather in England. I don't know.
It's not sunny enough over there. You guys don't have a cheery.
I mean, it's super sunny in Australia though. And I do it too. So I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah. I've seen it likened to Abercrombie for sure. And I would agree, like, yep. some of the stuff in his first law, you know, does sure. have that kind of little bit of smuttiness, like not maybe to the degree, at least to which you've done a little bit, especially in Empire, a little bit, you know, in Gabriel's, you know, 15-year-old self, you know,
sure.
there's a particular scene in mind, but I mean, yep. and again, that is something I've never seen before. So you blew my mind with that scene.
I mean,
I'm sure you know what I'm talking about.
I do. I felt like I had to. I felt like not addressing that in a vampire novel would be really disingenuous. It would be unavoidable.
Right.
It's hard to talk about this without getting into spoilers. It happens pretty quickly in the book.
Yeah, in
the very early stages of it. Yeah, it felt disingenuous not to talk about that. It felt kind of cowardly. So, yeah, and
I'm going to go for it.
Yeah, man, go all in. Like, all in must win.
I mean, you're at this point. I mean, you've had all this success, so you're like, let's just do it.
Roll the dice, see what happens.
So, just to kind of ask a few questions about some stuff you've kind of already gone over through the synopsis. Why does Gabriel's story deserve to be told? Like, why his story in particular? I mean, you've got all these other characters that play massive roles throughout his childhood and his older years. But what is it specifically about him? Is it the fact that he's this last Silver Saint? You know, was he always going to be when you brought his character to life? Or did you have somebody else in mind and Gabriel just kind of like started outshining everybody else? I'm just curious what it was about him.
It was always about him. Like I say, I kind of come from a visual arts background. I'm a visually minded writer. So I usually start with imagery. Like, imagery will just kind of creep into my head. So for Never Night, I the visual point I started with Never Night was, you know, Emily the Strange. I don't know if you're aware of this cartoon character called Emily the Strange. She, if you Google her, you will know her immediately. She's like on lunchboxes and backpacks and stuff. She's this little goth girl surrounded by cats.
And now I got to look it up while you're going through it.
Yeah. You'll know it as soon as you see it because it's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
But
yeah.
The visual for Never Night was a grown-up version of Emily the Strange. She has the same kind of aesthetic as Mia, that sharp black bangs over her eyes and long black hair surrounded by cats. So that's usually where I start. I start with an image of the character in my head. And the image I had for Empire was that image of Gabe in the opening chapter, him standing by the window watching the sun go down. So it was this picture in my head of a guy standing by a window up in a tower watching the sun die. And that kind of, that they were the images that started the whole book rolling in my head. So yeah, it was always about Gabe from the very beginning. I knew the kind of story that I wanted to tell. The origins of the of the story that Gabriel is part of, it really started with Nevernight. There's a character in Nevernight called Mercurio, who is Mia's mentor. He's the assassin that kind of brought her under his wing as a kid and kind of trained her up. And he's this grumpy old bastard. Like, he hates life and hates the world, but he loves her. And I really like the dynamic between the two of them. Whenever on the page, I just had so much fun writing them together. I love that trope of the kind of grizzled, world-weary mentor who hates life and hates everything, but loves this plucky young protege who kind of reignites the fire of life in the mentor, while the mentor kind of teaches the protege that life isn't all puppies and rainbows, that sometimes it kicks you in the teeth. I love that dynamic. But Mia and Mercurio's relationship was kind of set in stone. It had to be because of the way Nevernight worked. He was like a constant fixture in her life. He was the mountain that she could set her back against when everything else was going wrong. So what I wanted to do with Empire is show the formation of a relationship like that, like build a found family dynamic between two people that really didn't like each other and had every reason in the world to hate each other, but just got thrown into this furnace together and ended up kind of cleaving to each other and needing each other, mm-hmm. like family. There's something really powerful in the idea of family that you choose rather than family that you're given. Like, you don't get to choose your brothers and sisters, you don't get to choose your kids, but finding someone in life that you care about just as much as kin, who aren't related to you, there's something really powerful in that in terms of storytelling. So that was the story that I wanted to tell. So they were the two grounding points for the book, and everything just kind of sprawled out from there. The first chapter I wrote it's the first chapter of the old Gabe storyline with his horse. I won't go into super spoilery stuff, but yeah, that was the first scene that I wrote. And once I had that in my head, I kind of knew who Gabe was. I knew what kind of character he was, and I just went from there.
I gotcha. As far as, sorry, I got a dog barking outside, so my dog's went.
That's all good, man.
As far as the way in which you wrote it, so you know, you write this story about, you know, with a chronicler, and Gabe is telling his story, but yet he tells two stories. You know, why? That format, and instead of just kind of a straightforward starting, you know, with Gabe at 15 and then like leading up to 32, is it just the way the story came to you? Did you just start writing it? You're like, you know, it would be great if I did it this way. I'm just curious because that's a very interesting way to write it. Cause a lot of fantasy is very straightforward. It's not, it's not really a story told by the actual character, I guess. You know, you just see it from a perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I had the idea. I wanted to write a broken paragon, like a guy who had been a hero and had fallen on really hard times. Like, to me, you know, you look at that in a meta plot structural sense. You have the point where he is becoming the paragon, the point where he is the paragon, and the point where he stops being it. The least interesting part of those three arcs is the one in the middle, when everything is going right, when he's right. Top of the world and everyone loves him and he's kicking all the goals and he's winning MVP. Like, I don't care about that story. I don't give a shit. I want to see how he became it.
Yeah.
And what he became when the music stopped, when all the screams stop.
Mm-hmm.
When you're famous, life is easy. When you're not, that's when you find out when fame goes away, that's when you find out who you really are. So I wanted, I thought it would be a more interesting story to show those two extremes. Like, you meet young Gabe, he's full of idealism and fire and faith and the belief that he can change the world. Like, he's fully convinced that he is supposed to be doing what he is doing and he is going to make a difference. And then you meet him at 32 and he's like the exact opposite of that. They're almost two completely different characters. And so hopefully the question that prompts in your head is why? Like, how did this kid become this guy? What happened to you? Who hurt you, dude? And that's really what the whole story is about. That's the question at the root of the first book. It's like, who hurt you and how?
Mm-hmm.
And so that question is kind of omnipresent throughout the narrative, and eventually you find out.
Mm-hmm.
But that question was kind of, it was rooted at the start of the story when I started thinking about it. I knew why Gabe was the way he was. So yeah, that was the most interesting way I could think of telling that story, to show those two extremes and have that present, that question kind of omnipresent in the reader's mind. But also, you know, anti-heroes are more fun to me than heroes. I like kind of more morally gray characters. Yeah. They feel more realistic to me. So yeah, that was the most interesting way I could think to build that story, to tell that. And it kind of harkens back to, you know, there are a lot of great stories that have done it in that fashion, you know, Name of the Wind and Interview with the Vampire. You know, there's the film The Usual Suspects, which is just one guy sitting and telling a story. But going to The Usual Suspects, one of the questions that I hope is omnipresent in the reader's head when they're reading Empire is everything Gabriel saying true? Like, he's telling his version of events. Are his perceptions of what happened accurate? Or is he just straight out lying? Like, he's in captivity of monsters that he has hunted and killed his entire life. Like, why would he be telling them the whole and unabridged truth of what happened to him? So yeah, hopefully that question is present as well.
I'm waiting to see if there's any truths like hidden in his back pocket that he's not telling yet.
Right. Yeah. And is he playing a bigger game? You know, there is part of the meta plot is kind of built around the framing device, you know, Gabriel being in captivity. How did he get there? Why is he there? Why is he talking to these people that he hates? So yeah, it's just a more interesting framing device than I was 15 and then I was 16 and then I did this cool thing and I became a hero. Like, yeah, that wasn't as dynamic to me as framing things a little bit more ambiguously.
Then I was 21 and I've already been drinking for 6 years and
sure. Chronic alcoholic. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, I think that's kind of why I gravitate more towards like grimdark and dark fantasy than I do like epic high fantasy. Granted, I mean, and you're very much of the right, like US authors really gravitate towards the high fantasy and UK authors really gravitate towards to like the morally gray, like grimdark type fantasy or dark fantasy. But sure. Yeah, it's something about like having somebody that who's just like so good, like they're not like there has to be something there, like that they've got another side to them, like it's just not being told. And I really like,
yeah, nobody is that nice.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, and you were talking about how, you know, you've got the like the grizzled vet type character, and that's kind of what Gabriel's story is on one half when he's 32. But you know, you kind of look at like Logan Nine Fingers in The First Law.
Sure.
I don't know if you've read Michael Fletcher's Manifest Illusion series at all, but you've got a character Bedecht, who's like this older type that's just like war torn, you know, and just like hates everything. It's just again, chronic alcoholic. It just kind of goes hand in hand, I feel. But you know, it's that, you know, why did they get to this point? What did it? Why are they still like this? Like, why can they not get out of this? You almost want to call it a funk.
Sure.
And, you know, why do they continue just to be horrible people, but you can't, like, it's like an accident. You can't look away.
Yeah. I mean, it comes back to that old axiom, you know, when fighting monsters, you have to be careful not to become the monster. Like, if you're living a life in the dark, fighting evil, it's going to leave a mark. And the world that I have built is supremely dark. Like, it's an incredibly dangerous place to live and horrible things happen all the time. Like, your humanity has essentially become cattle to these creatures. And there are kind of tiny spots of civilization in this ocean of blackness, and there's no end in sight. Like, it's not like day's death is, it's not like the sun is getting brighter. It's like, this is the new status quo. Mm-hmm. And we were once the top of the food chain, and now there's something out there that's bigger and badder than any of us. And life becomes just a day-to-day struggle. So if you're on the front line of that struggle for years, yeah, it's going to leave a mark. It's going to change you. And that's one of the questions at the heart of the story. You know, what price do people pay for that devotion? And can that level of devotion last in the face of, yeah, the kind of unending bleakness of this world? Like, how do you maintain faith in the face of this atrocity? How do you believe in a God that loves you when you look around and just see a world on the brink of absolute collapse. So yeah, those are interesting questions to me. So yeah, that's kind of at the root of Gabriel's character. Faith is a really big part of the story. You know, Gabe is raised religious. He's indoctrinated into a religious order. And when you're young, it's easy to believe that, you know, you're the chosen one, and God is going to take care of you. And if you just say your prayers and do what you're told, everything will work out okay. But then you go out into the real world and figure out that it doesn't work that way. You maybe don't have the power to change the world. The people that you like and love start falling all around you, and all of a sudden you're questioning everything. So yeah, that struggle to maintain belief in the face of just the realities of life is one of the questions at the heart of Gabe's character.
Yeah. So we've got book one out. Can you say anything about book two? Do you have a working title? Can you say what we can expect in book two? I mean, clearly we're going to be expecting a longer book, which you've already mentioned.
Yeah, it will be longer. Like not crazy longer, but every sequel that I have ever written has been, yeah, probably like 10, 20% longer than the book that comes before it. It's just the way it goes. Like books tend to sprawl.
Right.
So yeah, it will almost certainly be longer. I've written probably a little over a third of it. I'm going to be working on it today. I have a working title, but the working title is a little bit spoilery if you haven't read book one. So I won't share it just because I don't want to spoil anyone's fun. In terms of what it's about, again, it's difficult to go into. You get a much broader view of the world, I guess. So Empire, even though it's a pretty big continent, you really only see kind of a slice of it. Like the journey is kind of from a town to the south, off a couple of rivers to a monastery in the north. And so you kind of see a sliver of the continent. Most of the action in book two takes place in the West, which is a country called Osway. That's the etymology and naming conventions and cultural conventions are kind of based on Scots Gaelic. So you see a little bit more of the war in the West, which hasn't been going well. You see more of vampire politics because there are multiple bloodlines and they're all kind of vying for ascendancy. One bloodline, the Voss, have been more successful than everybody else, but there are other bloodlines kind of trying to carve out their chunks. So you see a little bit more of the way that vampires interact with each other. You see more vampire politics at play. You find out a lot more about vampire history. You know, these things have been around for hundreds and hundreds of years, and the old ones know each other and they don't like each other. They're kind of, you know, the theory behind it is, you know, you throw two lions into a cage together, one of them ends up eating the other. You know, they don't share well. They're kind of territorial and predatory. So you get to see the vampire lines kind of bouncing off each other, and Gabe kind of caught in the middle of it. But also I can say there is a second narrator as well. I won't say who, but there is another prisoner in the tower with Gabe. And so you're getting, in book two, you're getting two points of view. Ooh. And you begin to understand that, like I said, the way Gabe perceives the world, the way Gabe perceives characters in a story are colored by his own perceptions and experiences and prejudices. So, you know, you get two people telling a story about a bar fight from opposite ends of the bar. They'll probably tell you different stories. You know, there'll be a fight, but one might know why it happened. One might see the aftermath. So you're getting different perspectives on the what's and the why's in book two, which is really fun to play with. So that's kind of where I'm at with book two at the moment. Okay. I'm grinding on that. I got a letter in my inbox from my editor this morning asking when it's arriving. So I'm not answering that email for the time being.
Just gonna mark that as read, and then also
mail received.
Yeah. last question I got for you. Is there anything recently that you've read that you'd recommend?
Hell yeah. So I finished Shadow of the Gods by John Gwynn, which is the start of his new series. He's the author of Malice. He's an English author. He's kind of in the Grimdark family as well. And he just started a new series called Shadow of the Gods. And it's awesome, man. I love it. I love his writing in general, but this setting in particular is really cool. And he's great lyrically and great world building wise. So yeah, I thoroughly recommend that. I read the new Peter V. Brett book, Desert Prince, which is the, I guess you would call it the successor series to The Core. So he did, I think there was five novels in his Demon Cycle series. And this new novel is set like 15, 16 years after the events of the last book in Demon Cycle. And that's awesome. It's really great. Start of a new series, but it's in a familiar world. So, but the cool thing is I don't think you have to know the previous books to pick up on this new series. Like I've read the previous series, so I'm familiar with it, but I think you did a really great job of you being able to just pick up the new book and roll with it. Like, yeah, which is really hard to do. You did a great job on it. And I'm reading Nosferatu by Joe Hill.
Okay.
So I'm reading a lot of dudes at the moment. I usually read a lot of ladies, but I've read a lot of dude novels lately. but yeah, Shadow of the Gods and Desert Prince are both great.
Okay. You and I actually share some space on the back of Shadow of the Gods, the UK.
Oh, you blurbed it as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, see if you liked it. It's a great book. Oh, gosh. I really like it. I think it's his best work to date.
It's amazing. Writing. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really
good. Yeah, I saw that and I was like, hey, I share a cover with Jay Kristoff.
There you go.
So that's awesome. Yeah, I definitely recommend those as well. So definitely great choices. Well, Jay, just seriously, from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much for coming on and chatting with me. Empire of the Vampire is one of my top reads of this year. Reread it again at least once or twice for the end of the year because I just freaking loved it. And I'll probably re-listen to Damien's narration because he is Gabriel De Leon to be.
He did a great job. So good.
Yeah, speaking of John Gwynn, you know, he did the Fateful and the Fallen narration. Did, yeah. So
that's how I found out about him.
So if you like the narration for Empire, go listen to Fateful and the Fallen.
he did an amazing job. But yeah, John's books was how I found out about Damien. So yeah, there you go.
That's awesome. Small world. That's awesome. Well, everybody go check out Empire of the Vampire. You can find it wherever books are sold. Jay, best of luck writing book two. Definitely looking forward to it. And we'll have to do this again for sure.
Yeah, man. Definitely. Thanks for your time.
Awesome. It was awesome. Thank you.
Awesome.